You're measuring the antenna pattern at a large distance. That's half of what you need to know on this one, Andy. KD2ESY, you've been worrying a little bit unnecessarily. K2LIW, please shout a little louder into that low gain microphone.
K2, Jack. K2RW, KD2ESY. I won't torture you anymore. That is somewhat helpful. I do appreciate it very much. And so I am going to sign for the evening. Thank you so much, Dick. We'll keep reading up on the subject. KD2ESY, I'll be clear.
Very well, Andy. Thank you for all that extra audio. Now you've come up to the half value of audio that you should be. Before, you were at one-tenth value, and some people are going to have trouble hearing you. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
FIU comment.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I just wanted to give you a little real-world example for him to think about. Two things, actually. One is where this repeater is. There's actually a couple of dozen antennas that it sits by, and there are other 2-meter antennas up there, and UHF antennas and so forth. The biggest problem that you have operating even in the same band is you wind up killing the mixer in the front end of the radio, and you wind up with intermodulation problems, and wind up smashing the IP3 up into the roof, and you get all this junk that the commercial guys have to worry about and get rid of. The other thing that I wanted to point out is, let me write that for a second.
But except for the interference to the other rig, the antennas themselves almost do not see each other. Is that roughly true, Eric?
Definitely true in terms of looking at your own stuff. Although you have other signals on the band, and then being so strong and, you know, the antennas are literally less than a foot, about a foot apart in some places. And you have to deal with the... with that issue, and what we generally do is put an optical filter on the offending frequency and try and get some of that energy out of the receiver. The other thing that I wanted to point out is that my TV transmitter, where I'm transmitting half a megawatt, actually it's a little bit less than that, and I send a guy up the tower, and I'm using this side-mounted antenna, and these guys have RF monitors on it that give them an alarm when it reaches a certain number of signal as you approach the antenna. As you get close to the antenna, those things don't fire off until you're maybe about a foot under the antenna. You go up past the antenna, and it may be about another foot or so, the alarm on your RF, personal RF safety monitor goes off. Just to give people a little idea of how much near field is actually above and below the antenna. K2RIW, K2J.
Very fine. Very fine, Eric. George, recognize. We're going to get you in a second, George. So the collinear television, UHF television broadcast antenna that Eric uses on his broadcast tower in Plainview, as well as the one that's in Empire State Building, it's got an extremely sharp antenna pancake pattern out on the horizon. It squirts very little signal straight up and straight down. Therefore, that man climbing the mast a few feet below that antenna, or a few feet above that antenna, his radiation hazard monitor, measuring milliwatts per square centimeter, making sure that you're not exceeding the radio frequency biohazard for that man, and making him sick, so to speak, affecting his eyes, that doesn't go off, because that antenna pattern, because he's got multiple elements vertically stacked inside that broadcast antenna, all fed in phase, creating a phased array antenna pattern, pancake pattern, all 360 degrees out to the horizon with very little elevation to it. So, as you can tell, antenna patterns. If you feel uncomfortable with this one, Andy, number two, you're in very good company. The information we've been given in all the books we read and all of the courses that we take, in my opinion, do a fairly mediocre or less job on that one. George wanted to make a comment or a question. KD2FIU, K2RIW. Go ahead, George.
Thank you, Dick. This is George, KD2FIU. Regarding the two vertical antennas and the distance that you want to have them away from each other to work the same frequency or the same band and very close to the same frequency, there are very specific distances you want to avoid in order for it, for you two different operators to work. You want to avoid a end fire or a collinear gain. If you have them quarter wave, half wave, or three halves of wave specifically separated from each other, the RF energy will work in gain, and you will just actually intermodulate and distort each other out. So try and space them away or away from the specific multiple numbers that will give you an end fire or a crossfire gain.
What's an end fire gain?
I fairly strongly disagree with what we have just heard. I think, George, either we're misunderstanding the mechanical diagram you're describing, or you have been victimized by a lot of people with that opinion. If you're talking about RF energy being launched onto the launching pipe coupling between the antennas, yes, there are specific distances that'll do some funny things. But if antenna number one and antenna number two are vertically stacked, collinear with each other, and they're both in free space, there is no magic spacing.
Repeater, time out.
If the two antennas are vertically stacked, collinear, not offset from each other, they're both vertically polarized, vertically stacked, in free space, so to speak. They're mounted on a fiberglass pole, so there's no current crawling along the metal mass. There is no magic spacing that makes more or less coupling. Good common sense, what you're saying. A hell of a lot of guys on 20 meters have opinions like that. I strongly disagree. I don't blame you if you think I'm wrong on this one. We can always do a little bit more research and find better references to confirm this. There is no magic spacing. If I'm making a near-field measurement in a collinear manner, in other words, I've got an instrumentation. Let me drop. I've got a vertically polarized, we'll say, 2-meter antenna. Maybe it's 5/8 wave, maybe it's quarter wave, maybe it's half wave. And it's intended to send a signal out to the horizon. And I'm now using instrumentation. And I'm directly below that antenna with my instrumentation and slowly moving away from it. Or I'm directly above the antenna with my instrumentation. I'm slowly moving away from it. And I'm measuring the signal strength. First of all, because I'm in the null portion of the pattern, I'm going to see a fairly small amount of signal. That small amount of signal, as I move away, will fall off by the inverse square law. Up super close is another crazy characteristic, perhaps, but at reasonable spacings of a couple of feet, and then 3 feet, 10 feet, 20 feet, and so on, the signal will continuously fall off in an inverse square law. There is no magic spacing. Maybe you're describing a different physical layout than the one I just did. KD2FIU for a clarification. K2RIW. Go ahead, George.
W2HWW, another comment, please.
George first. Go ahead, George.
Hey, what I'm explaining here is that you want to avoid any intentional phasing by avoiding the spacing. You can't avoid it if you're having any type of resistive commonality in the stations having the same grounding field. Whether you're in the same station itself, the two different transmitters, or whether you're in the same field of ground in a field day or something like that, there will be some commonality as to your ground. So you will have, you're not in free space at that point. you want to avoid specific spaces between the two verticals if your two different stations working the same frequency or on the same band relative to the same frequency. Because if you work those stations, if there's any commonality of ground that you're working with, you will have start phasing together.
Very good. Hold on now. Your antenna has its own independent ground. You're making believe now that they both refer back to a common ground, like the Earth that's 30 feet below this antenna structure. Absolutely not. Each individual antenna has its own local ground, its own local counterpoise, if it's a good design. Therefore, there is no coupling between the two. I know that you and I disagree on this one. Let's see what Eric's got to say. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I think George is mistaking DC as it is. He's using DC as his thinking and not realizing what RF is. The one thing that I will say is that if you look at the at a sales brochure for a good station master, there are ways to change the pattern based upon how you mount it against the tower. There is, in that situation, the number of wavelengths, the quarter wavelength of the mount has an effect on the radiation pattern. But when it comes to the near field, same thing again. You can mount many people do. You mount multiple station masters, one above each other, perfectly in line. They've got to be in a straight vertical line with each other. They absolutely have no effect on one another.
And in that scenario you just described, Eric, are you agreeing with me, possibly, on this one, that in what you just described, two station masters both set, let me pick a number, 3 feet off the side of a tower, and one's 10 feet above the other. In that scenario, there is no magic spacing between these two collinear vertical station masters that create mysterious coupling between the two. There's no magic spacing. That's what I'm saying, and that's what I think you're saying, Eric. KE2EJ for a confirm. K2LIW.
WB2HWW on a comment.
We'll get to it in a second, Howie. You know, that's exactly what I'm saying, Dick. Actually, there are situations where you can put an antenna horizontally across from one another, which actually will change the resonance frequency of the antenna if they're really close. By a tiny amount, well, it depends on the band, but the amount of effect that you get there, it's pretty minuscule. But when they're in line, vertically, one on top of each other, and I've seen antenna installations where they're literally a foot apart, and they don't affect one another in any way, shape, or form. So, yes, I agree with you. K2RIW, K2J, and I give it to Howie.
So to repeat what Eric and I are saying, George, we have a strong way to believe, and Eric has got a lot of experience actually doing it. There is no magic spacing, quarter wave, half wave, three-quarter wave, odd quarter wave, even quarter wave, whatever. There is no magic spacing in that case. The lobes of the antenna pattern that you see on the three-dimensional patterns, if the customer, if the vendor gives you this beautiful pattern of the antenna, those lobes only exist at some long distance away from the antenna. You could mistakenly think that those lobes of one antenna wraps around the other antenna, that it's going to explode, catch on fire, and all kinds of bad things are going to happen. Absolutely not true. WB2HWW, K2RIW, go ahead, Howie.
I want to make two comments. I agree with both of what you guys are saying. And from experience, you get more isolation. In the old days, when you wanted to duplex, let's say on 2 meters or on 432, you didn't have a full duplex. You need two antennas. You get more isolation when you do vertical separation than you do horizontal. That's due to the umbrella effect. So you get less effect. You have to, the antennas can be closer together if you're trying to duplex, or you want less interference if they're vertically separated. Yes, and there are antennas like dipole antennas. There's a couple of like side-mounted dipoles that fell parachute to sell. And if you mounted them so many feet off the side of the building or off the tower, you could change the pattern. But if you want to get isolation, Dick, and you know this, vertical separation is your best friend.
Yeah, I thank you, Howie. And the more you increase that vertical separation, the more you get isolation, 40, 50, 60 dB, of transmitting one being coupled into the other receiver, so to speak, and it falls off by inverse square law in a linear manner. I can tell, George, you've got pretty strong feelings on this one. And you've fallen into a trap. You've used good common sense. There's a hell of a lot of people on 20 meters and lower HF frequencies saying things like you're saying. The experience says it's not true. And it's going to take a while for you and I to settle this one, I can tell. That original question was by Andy. And, okay, we're going to move on now because we're getting a little bit late. Joe, W-H-2-R-Y-Y, Joe number one. You're right ahead with your question, Joe. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick. How you doing? I was playing with the RF fast loss formula, and I don't remember it exactly, but it seems to have a problem where if you decrease the numbers like frequency and or distance, you eventually come up with a number that's like a negative number as far as your answer or your result. I give an example. You probably have a calculator handy, correct?
That's a big 10-4, good buddy. Yes, I do. Go ahead.
Okay, just to see if I'm doing it right. Take a frequency like 100 meg at a distance of 1 mile, and you get a path loss of approximately 71 decibels. Does that sound about right?
That's the right ballpark. Please proceed.
Do you agree with that answer?
It's the right ballpark. In other words, is it 73.1 or 70? It's in that ballpark of numbers. The formula that Joe is referring to is a very handy formula. If you've got two antennas that you believe have no gain, isotropic antennas, 0 dB over ISO gain, or unity gain if you express it as a hard number. Let me drop. This very handy formula is that the amount of decibels of coupling between the two antennas in decibels is this formula, 36.6 plus 20 times log of frequency plus 20 times log of distance. Frequency is megahertz, distance is miles. So once again, the formula is 36.6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D. Now, if you make the mistake of plugging in the distance of not a mile, but you plug in an inch, the formula breaks down. You get to a super close spacing. The formula will give you crazy numbers. You can't use that formula a foot away from a great big antenna. 10 foot, 100 foot, yes, works like a charm. So over to you, Joe, W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, I must have been remembering the formula not correctly, because it seemed like when I decreased the frequency by a factor of 10 times, it gave me a decibel loss that was 20 dB less. So apparently I'm not doing the formula right.
You're doing the formula exactly right, because the formula is 36.6 plus 20 times log of frequency plus 20 times log of distance. You change the distance by 10 to 1. You change the frequency by 10 to 1. The log as a number changes by a integer, unity, so to speak, and you multiply it by 20. You change the distance or the frequency by 10 to 1. You will see a 20 decibel change. That is the inverse square law. You're getting the right answer. You just don't believe it. I've been down that road in the beginning. It's hard to believe these answers when you're not making a math error. I think you're getting the right answer, Joe. W-H-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet. Ain't Mother Nature strange?
Okay, just to see if I'm doing it right. Take a distance of, say, a tenth of a mile and a frequency of 100 kilohertz. what do you get for path loss using those numbers? 100 kilohertz, which is 0.1 megahertz, and 0.1 miles.
Okay, stand by. I'll be back in 30 seconds. -3.4. Yes, it's got gain. There's 100 kilohertz gives you stand by now. The wavelength of 100 kilohertz is something like 30,000 feet. And you're a tenth of a mile, which means you're only 500 feet away. You're way inside a fraction of a wavelength. The formula breaks down there. You're inside of the reactive near field. The fact that you measured -3.6, which really means you're measuring gain. The antenna now has gain because you're so close, but you're in such a small fraction of a wavelength. The formula doesn't work under those conditions, Joe. To B2LYY, wait for the beeps, K2LIW.
Okay, now I see what the problem is. Yeah, I see what. So you're showing the same thing. So it was an error with my calculator, actually showing a a number other than what you would expect to see. Okay, go on to the next slide.
Yeah, Joe, you're going through a very educational experience. The first time we start using these formulas, if you think this is bad, this is the formula for free space, which is boiled down to three factors. A fixed number, 36.6 dB, plus 20 times the log of frequency F, plus 20 times the distance D. You boil it down to three simple factors, two factors and a constant. That formula is a simplification of the so-called radar range equation. You go to Skolnick's book on Introduction to Radar, and you look up the radar range equation, where they're plugging in numbers of radar cross-section and free space loss and dielectric constants. They got about 10 factors in that formula. You plug all the factors into the radar range equation and you try to come up with an answer. You've got about a 50-50 chance that one of the numbers you've put in is supposed to be megahertz and you put it in hertz, or it's supposed to be hertz and you put it in megahertz, and the magnetic field is wrong, the E field is wrong. You can easily get something wrong. The number of chances of getting it right with the real basic radar range equation is tough. This formula does a beautiful job of boiling it down to simplicity, but still you're now rediscovering. If you're way, way inside of the near field range of the antenna, you're at a small fraction of one wavelength. The wavelength is miles, and you're 100 feet away or 500 feet away. The formula breaks down there. And it's telling you a kind of truth. Let me drop. If you start off with some reasonable VHF antenna, and you start off making measurements with good laboratory instrumentation 1 mile away, and you're on this great big baseball field, you're on the great big athletic field at a great big school, and you slowly, with your portable equipment, start walking toward the antenna. For most of your walking, you'll find inverse square law. Every time you take the distance down by 2 to 1 in range, you'll see a 4 to 1 increase in power, 6 dB increase. Change the range by 10 to 1, you'll see a 20 dB increase. So inverse square law is 20 dB per decade, 6 dB per octave. Those are the round numbers that the people use. As you get super close to the antenna, a few feet away, it's no longer inverse square law. It becomes inverse third, fourth, and fifth law. And pretty soon when you get super close to the antenna, you're getting direct capacitive coupling between the radiator and your instrumentation. And you'll see answers that are crazy. You'll think that your 100-watt output transmitter is putting out 10 kilowatts, if you know what I mean. It's phony. So Mother Nature really does it up close. The formula gives you a hint. The formula is doing it for a different reason, by the way. But you're going through a beautiful educational process. I've been down that road, Joe. I got scared at first when I saw it. And right now, you happen to be accurate, even though Mother Nature's a little crazy. Okay, we're going to go over to the next person on this list, and that was Joe number two, KC2QYW. Wait for the beeps. You got it, Joe. Number 2, K2LIW.
Roger, roger. How you guys doing? Yeah, Dick, have you ever wrote a book on antennas or on amateur radio in general? Did you ever, like, publish, say, a book out? I was always wonder about that. Back to you.
You're really asking, am I an educator? By way of 36 years of the TechNet, that's one place where I've been teaching. And you guys have been in my classroom. And I'm not the only guy giving answers, you know. That, there are times when I'm dead wrong, and other people are giving us information. I'm particularly light on information with computers. I'm particularly light on HF propagation. I spend very little time on HF. I'm a microwaver. Also, by way of the microwave reflector run by Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA, in the Boston area, he has for the last 30 years run this microwave reflector where he's got about 400 guys worldwide. Let me drop. 400 true microwave people. Microwave is usually defined as 1,000 megs and above, 1296 and above. These guys run 10 gigs, 20 gigs, 24 gigs, 78 gigs, 241 gigs. Happens to be the guy down in Virginia who's the top of the heap, if you know what I mean. These guys help each other with equipment, with answers on how things work. So I have published a whole lot of articles on the microwave reflector as to what happens. As to what happens when you get super close to an antenna and you've got nearby interferences, and you've got crazy antenna patterns, and you're multi-moding your waveguide. You would think that all the books on proper use of waveguide will tell you that a piece of WR90 waveguide, WR stands for waveguide rectangular, 90 means it's 9/10 of an inch wide. All the books tell you to use it between 8.4 and 12.4 gigs only. Okay? These guys are discovering when they take this waveguide rated for 8.4 to 12.4 gigahertz, and 10.3 gigs is the ham band that they most often use, if instead of feeding the waveguide on 10 gigs, they feed a signal from the waveguide at 24 gigs, 47 gigs, 78 gigs, 124 gigs, they go to much higher frequencies where the waveguide is multimoding. And if you're now sweeping the waveguide at a super high frequency, you would see a scalloped pattern, peaks and valleys. But they're carefully choosing the length and the peaks, and they carefully tune the situation. And when they do that, at their handband, narrow, crystal-controlled frequencies, you get this huge improvement. The waveguide loss almost disappears at their favorite frequencies. They're breaking the rules and finding great benefits. So there's a hell of a lot of rules out there where if you're trying to build a system that is completely flat in frequency. Let me drop. You want to build a system that's completely flat in frequency response across a fraction of a octave. And yes, you have to obey those rules. But our handbands, our microwave handbands, are very specific frequencies. Almost every one of the handbands are some harmonic of 144.0 megahertz. The reason for that is when the guys are setting up their receiver converter for the first time, they need a test signal. They take their 2-meter rig, set it at 144.000, press down the key, and listen to the 72nd harmonic at 10.368 gigahertz. They've got their own marker. They listen to the 72nd harmonic, and you listen to the higher harmonics on the higher band. All the microwave handbands, the favorite frequencies, the calling frequencies, by some exact multiple of 144. Because if you don't have something traceable to the bureau to test the frequency, you can find your own harmonics of your rig, and you slowly build a ladder and work your way up to these crazy frequencies. So, yes, I have virtually written a book by way of the articles that I've put on the microwave reflector. Let me drop. There are a whole bunch of guys out there that have gathered all of the articles that I've published over the last 15 or so years, and they put them all into one particular file. They call it the K2LIW file, so to speak. And these guys have got all of these articles. In fact, 10 of those articles you're going to find when you go to QRZ.com, or LimeOnTechNet.com. You go to either of those websites, and you'll find these articles by K2RIW that were published on the microwave reflector. Some of them are about how to use a 3/4-inch water pipe as a waveguide at 10 gigs, or how to build your own dummy load, or what really is the response of a UHF connector at microwave frequencies, and so on. There's a bunch of articles. So I have virtually written a book. Have I really published it all in one chunk of paper? No. And if I did, it would be a hell of a lot of work, Joe. And there's only 30 people out there who would buy it. And if you go through the amount of man hours, man years of effort to write a good book, get it published, pay for the printing, and so on, and you only sold 30 copies, economically, you're going to make a lot of loss. So this part of what's going on. Let me drop. Is in the general population in so-called technical areas, United States, Canada, most of Europe, most of Japan, Australia, in those technically competent countries, first world countries, so to speak, you have very close to one ham per 500 in the general population. One ham per 500 people. Serious microwave operators, the guys who are above 1 gigahertz, you have one of them for 500 hams. You're getting down to 250,000 people for one in the general population for one microwave ham radio operator. And yes, the stuff that I published addresses those people. There's about 1,000 of those people worldwide, all talking to each other on this microwave reflector of Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA. So it's got a very narrowed audience. A very enthusiastic, slightly crazy people, and only 30 of them would buy the book if I go through the man year of work of building it, Joe. That's part of my problem. But maybe someday I really will do it. KC2QIW, great question. K2IW, the TechNet.
Kind of a major resource, just sitting right next to you.
Yeah, your club alone has like 400 members. Yeah, I'm impressed. I'll check it out on the website when I get a chance. And I just want to say sorry for the silent key. I'm not sure which one is that, John. Silent key. Rest in peace. Was that the guy that had the high pitch voice? Back to you, then.
Yeah, the silent key is Joe. Correction, John. KD2IXB Kilo Delta 2 India X-ray Papa. I can go back through my list here and see all the...
Repeater, time out.
I could go back through my list here and see all the times that he has signed into the TechNet quite a few times. I don't think he's got an unusual-sounding voice. But he passed away this week. Now, the resource that you're referring to, Eric, you're saying I got a resource right alongside of me. Maybe you're talking about the Internet. And the good news is there's a tremendous amount of information if you use the right search words on the Internet. Got to be careful, though. A little bit of this is phony news, as Mr. Trump would say. Lies. KE2EJ, K2RIW, what were you referring to, Joe, Eric?
K2RIW, K2EJ. No, it's a living human being that you live with. He's there all the time. And it wouldn't take much for him to put together a website which has all your good papers, and then create a Google search for it. And you'll probably be surprised how many thousands of times people would visit that site and read it beyond the 400 people that's part of W1MDA's reflector. It wouldn't take much for them to do, and it wouldn't be a bad thing to do either. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Yeah, he's referring to my son, who's a computer maven. That's one of the places where I'm real light. That's a possibility to help me do the publishing. Eric, this is the first time in a long time your audio is actually too hot. Something happened to your mic, and it's too hot, Eric. Go ahead.
Okay, I apologize.
I was really eating it because you're always telling me it's too low.
Now, whatever you just did is perfect. But you were over-modulating on the previous transmission.
Yeah,
I should publish. And, well,
what? You know, you're not going to live forever.
No, I know. Let me drop it.
Roger, Roger. Sorry, Dick. I didn't mean to put pressure on you to publish a book. You know, I was just wondering. Yeah, so.
There's another point I was going to make, and I just lost it. Oh, well. It'll come to me in a minute. Publishing is tough. If you do a good job of making a presentation to a group of people, for each hour of your presentation that you present, you're putting 10, 20, 30 hours of work into assembling the equipment, making the diagrams right, getting the right references, making the diagrams the right color, the right size, and whatever. There's a lot of work in publishing that doesn't meet the eye. And I've got a couple of projects I'm involved in right now. I want to put up another tower. I've got this beautiful chunk of tower sitting in my backyard, brand new, ready to go up in the air, and that's got a higher priority to me. Okay, I hope Rich is still with us. WB2 Golf X-Ray Mike. Go right ahead, Rich. K2LIW in the tech net.
Dick and Toledo.
WB2 GXM. That's what I'm calling right now. Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray Mike. K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich.
K2RIW in the group, WB2GXM, Rich. Thank you, Dick. I went to the Half Fest this morning, and as you know, I've been caring for family for quite a few years. I was not able to get out of the house a lot. This has been my first Half Fest, and I want to tell everybody this was a wonderful, wonderful day. It was almost overwhelming, but I enjoyed it a lot. I needed. For anybody who can do this, I was wondering, can we do this like 6 times a year instead of just 3? K2RW on the TechNet, WB2GXM.
Yeah, it looks like somebody opened the door, sold 63 tables. Vendors came along who are taking their ham radio stuff they're no longer using out of their basement, or companies that really sell ham radio equipment. There's a lot of work going into setting those up. Behind the scenes, there's insurance that has to be cleared. Permissions have to be given by the people who own the property. You'd be amazed at all the stuff that goes through there. Now, glad to hear that I know a little bit about what you've been going through for the last few years, because you've described it to me, Rich. And glad you're out from under this impressive situation that you've come through, and now all of a sudden you're seeing the light of day. You're getting outside and getting a chance to walk through the green grass, if you know what I mean. But you saw a lot of ham radio equipment. In other words, if you needed all kinds of doodads, connectors and cables and wires and mixers and directional couplers and ham radio rigs that are used at the 10% of the normal price and so on. My guess is you saw an awful lot of stuff today. And you sat there and say, whoa, if I had enough money, boy, I'd buy half of all the stuff that I see. Tell me what you saw. I mean, you're a guy who has got a lot of interest in the hobby, but you've been held away from it by personal experience, by personal circumstances. You've been held away from it for a long time. Tell me what it was like, what you saw. What turned you on the most, Rich? WB2GXM. Try to tell us through your eyes what you saw. K2RIW. You got it, Rich.
Thank you, Dick. I don't know if I mentioned it in the first transmission. This has been my first Ham Fest, hard as that may be to believe. And I thought, since I didn't get there exactly at 9 o'clock, that there'd be nothing left, and what's the point? Well, no. I got there 2 hours late, and the place was still packed and wonderful. Lots. Personally found 6-volt DPDT relays, And you cannot find 6-volt relays if you look online. Nice. Thanks, Dick.
Okay. Right. Each, during that last transmission, Rich, your transmitter went on the air for 20 seconds and then off for 10 seconds. On for 20 seconds, off for 10 seconds. Either that or some other interference signal was coming along. So, we didn't hear everything you said, but you found double pole, double throw, 6-volt relays, which are rare as all hell, without a doubt. You'll find all kinds of rare things at these flea markets. And if you know what you're looking at, beauty is the eye of the beholder. You take a waveguide directional coupler made by Nada, for instance. They sell brand new for $1,000. On flea markets, they frequently sell for $5 or $10. Average guy doesn't know what he's looking at and ignores them. The marking on the... Let me drop it. The marking on the knife on the Nada directional coupler. This is a box that is about 8 inches long, about 3.5 inches wide, about 1 inch thick, with 3 type N connectors on it, painted blue with a red label on it. And the red label might say good from 100 to 300 megahertz, or it might say good from 500 to 1,000 megahertz. And the average ham says, hey, I'm on 14 megacycles. That's way out of my frequency range. That's useless. Who cares if it's $5? He puts his nose up in the air and walks away. If you understood how a directional coupler works, you can take that 500 to 1,000 megacycle waveguide directional coupler made by Nada. Inside, it's got strip lines. And if you use it at not 500 megacycles, but you use it at 14 megacycles, it has an extremely predictable performance. As a sampling device on your kilowatt transmitter, where it gives you 10 milliwatts of output as a sample on what's going on with your one gigahertz, your kilowatt or 1500 watt transmitter. It's an extremely valuable tool with no insertion loss, an extremely cheap high price, with very predictable performance when you use it at a range. Remember, I gave the example before of using, these guys are now discovering that when they use waveguide way out of range, they pick up a huge advantage of very low insertion loss. Let me drop. That Nada 10 dB coupler, it's rated for 10 dB of coupling. 1/10 of the power goes into the coupling port between 500 and 1,000 megs, where it's rated. And you're using it at 1/100 the frequency, so to speak. We're down at 14 megacycles. Instead of it being a 10 dB coupler, it's a 35.5 dB coupler, thoroughly calculatable. Okay? When you're measuring a kilowatt transmitter and your instrumentation is only good for milliwatts, that's exactly the thing you're looking at. It's a beautiful sampling device. I just use that as an example. Flea markets, if you know what you're looking at, if you talk to the right people and find out what has true value, if you know what I mean, which is very different than what's marked on the label sometimes. If you got smart enough, I know one of the other things I was going to mention before. You guys think that I should write a book, and I'm not a super smart guy. I've just been lucky enough to work for a very progressive company called Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I walked out of my Bachelor of Engineering school way back in 1964, sent out 120 resumes done on the school's IBM 1620 computer. This is back in the days before word processing had been invented. This automatic typewriter typed out 120 resumes for me, with each page, with all the typing impression into the paper. They know it wasn't just a mimeograph roll-off. Each company that got that resume for me thought that I had specifically typed a zero-error letter on that piece of paper and mailed it to them. Got a whole lot of job offers out of that. And this beautiful job over from Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I was in the right place at the right time, working for guys who invented strip lines, guys who invented some of the antennas and so on. 35 years of experience. Boy, I would spend every one of my noon hours choosing one of those very smart people. 1,050 degree engineers working for that company. Let me drop. I would choose one of them each individual noon hour and sit down and eat lunch with him and pick his brain. Boy, was there a resource there. So you're hearing a whole bunch of rules of thumb that are not taught in the schools, not in the books, stuff that really works. They had 35 antenna engineers. Boy, did I pick their brains. So that's where this information is coming from. It's not that I'm super smart. I was just in the right place at the right time for 35 years. And they were doing state-of-the-art work on the B-1B bomber airplane and the EA-6 standoff jammer airplane and the E-2C Navy airplane and the F-15 airplane. I did some beautiful work at the Rome Air Development Center on F-15s, full-size airplanes, making antenna measurements. What a hell of an experience. That's what you're hearing. Over to you. I guess it was you, Joe, who asked the question. No, I guess it was Rich who asked the original question. WV2GXM? Maybe I didn't answer it yet. K2RW, you got it, Rich.
Believe it for a second. That guy is more than super smart. And to be you.
WV2GXM. So, take a look at the dials on your rig, Rich, because each one of your transmissions, it looks like maybe you've got a low battery. You get 20 seconds worth of transmission and 10 seconds worth of complete dropout, and then it comes back on, and I can tell you don't know about it. So maybe your battery's low. So WV2GXM, K2RIW.
Out of the way. Your book would do well. Happy Fat Tuesday to everyone. WV2GX.
Yeah. Happy Fat Tuesday for everyone. We heard that, Joe. I mean, Rich. But almost everything else was a dropout, I'm sorry to say. So there's either an interference happening or your rig has a degree of intermittency. Rich, sounds like you want to say something. N2EO, you got a technical question, Rich? Please keep it technical. K2RIW, N2EO.
It's no problem, Dick. It's what you were talking about, writing a book and all that. The West Coast Handbook. I just looked it up. It's on Amazon. They call it the Radio Handbook, the W6SAI, the West Coast, all the same thing. Then I always consider it a much better book than what the League puts out. What's your opinion? And this is still in print. This is saying here 1997 print. Those have all about vertical antennas, William Moore, and radio antennas, handbook by William Moore.
Yeah, Bill Orr and Frank Jones are the two guys on the West Coast that have published some really beautiful books on VHF ham radio, starting in roughly 1968-1970 time frame with their original publishing. They do an extremely good job. And now you're asking me about other ARRL books. Let me tell you one of the secrets that was really not well advertised. AIL had the peak of their success when there were 6,000 engineers and 6,000 employees in the company at the peak of the B-1B bomber program when they had a $4 billion contract and 6,000 people in a company that normally holds 2,000 people, 35 antenna engineers. Almost every one of those antenna engineers on their bookcase had a book that's turned around backwards. By turned around backwards, I mean you're not looking at the spine of the book, you're looking at the pages of the book. The spine was buried in the back of the bookcase. Almost every one of the antenna engineers had that book. And when they're not in their office and you walk over to that book and pull it out, you find out, what is it? The ARRL antenna book. Almost every one of the antennas had the ARRL antenna book because it was written in English. It was easy to understand with beautiful graphs. A few of them had the Radio Amateur's Handbook. A few of them had a couple of the other advanced books on physics of antennas, for instance, is another book. So there's a number of ARRL books. written by very practical people, written in English with good diagrams, good illustrations, understandable, and a ridiculous number of the antenna engineers had those books on their shelf. So ARL does a beautiful job of publishing some very nice books. I don't know if I had to... Let me drop it.
Repeater, time out.
If I had to choose an ARRL book that's a dud, something that's not worth the paper it's printed on, I don't think there is one. I don't think I could find one. No. Those guys are... they've got their feet in the sand, their hand on the antenna, the other hand is on the transmitter or on the Morse code key. They're in the field doing the work, talking to people continuously, trading information back and forth as to what, how things really work. That's where the rubber meets the road. The only thing that comes close is the Radio Society of Great Britain. When I was at their headquarters in London, outside of London, I can't even think of the name of the town. It's got a crazy name, the town. Something in Hertz, as I remember. Anyhow, when you look at the things that they publish, equally invaluable, because these are people really touching the hardware on a day-to-day basis, writing books that have very useful information. N2EO, T2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Why was under the impression that the West Coast books by Biller were actually more thorough than the lead books. That's what I've been led to believe. Anyway, Dick, I'm not going to take up more of that time. You know, every week, I just realized this evening, when you want to tech that, my dog Bailey is right in here with me. She is laying in front of me, listening to the radio. Her name is Bailey, B-A-I-L-Y. She is a large yellow Labrador. With that, I'll just stand by to get to you.
Okay, hello, Bailey. Bailey apparently is a good listener. And there are a couple of ham radio wives who tell me that their husbands listen to the TechNet, and they wonder what I look like because they've been hearing my voice for years on end. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in who had a question or a comment. I'll give one more last call. Is there anybody who's not watching the Academy Awards who has a ham radio question or a comment that they want to make? Give me a call, letter, the name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2SAW.
W2SAW. Please start off with your name. I should know you. K2RIW. Go ahead, sir.
Good evening, Dick. This is W2SAW. The name is Phil. Simple question. I think if making a toroidal transformer 2 to 4, 1 to 4, 1 to 9, how do you choose the optimal number of turns to actually put on the toroid?
The right way to do it is to start off with somebody else's design that's close. If somebody's got a design where he's got a 4-to-1 transformer and you want to make it a 9-to-1 transformer, that means you're going to change the number of turns in the secondary. But he already has the primary with the right number of turns. So you copy his primary turns, and he has already chosen the right amount of iron and the right amount of primary turns. The process of him doing that, either he did that experimentally or he got fairly deep into the magnetic theory. It turns out that every piece of iron has a certain amount of permeability. That really means that the magnetic field flows through that iron. If it's got a permeability of 100, that means the magnetic field flows through that iron 100 times better than it does through air. It's the equivalent of a resistor with 1/100 the number of ohms, if you know what I mean. Let me drop it. So the permeability of the core tells you what kind of inductance you're going to get on that primary winding versus the number of turns. And the inductance in microhenries, millihenries, goes up as turns squared. That's one factor for selecting the turns. You want the primary inductance if it's a 50-ohm to a 1,000-ohm transformer, so to speak. And 50 ohms is the primary. You want the inductive reactance of the primary to be a high number of ohms compared to your impedance. I'd like it to be a high number of ohms compared to 50. I'd like it to be 500 ohms, so to speak. So that of the current that flows into that primary winding, only one-tenth of the current is because of the amount of inductance. The rest of it's going to be the loading factor. That's one factor. You've got to have a big enough chunk of iron that you can put 1,000 watts through it without it saturating. That's the second factor. It's got to have the right number of the right particle size of the iron so that you can use it up at 30 megacycles without it getting hot. So the hysteresis effect and the lost tangent and so on. So choosing the right size toroid, putting the right number of turns in the primary, these are some of the factors you're going to go through. If you find somebody else's design, commercial, ham radio, whatever, and copy his design and make your change, you're going to change the number of turns of secondary. That gives you the step-up impedance, if you know what I mean. And impedance is a function of turns squared. So step by step, you can do that. And by the way, if you just take a stab in the dark, pick up a good chunk of toroidal material and start winding turns on it, dumbly, you know that you want a step-up impedance of, let's assume that your step-up impedance is going to be 100 to 1. That means the turns ratio is going to be 10 to 1 because impedance is a function of turns squared. See, you know you're going to have 10 to 1 turns ratio. And you wind some wire, you take your enameled wire and you wind the primary and you wind the secondary, and if you get it wrong, the transformer will saturate, the transformer will run hot. Because you're running this experiment and you're testing it, it's not going to explode, it's not going to catch on fire. You put your power through it for a short period of time, you turn it off, you put your hand on and find out, is anything running hot? And is it giving you impedance step? So if you did it as a pure empirical experiment, because it's not dangerous if it's done correctly, you can't go wrong. But choosing somebody else's design is going to give you a leg up where you get the 3 steps ahead, if you know what I mean. It's not rocket science, but it is a little bit complicated. Let me drop. Sad to say that of all the electronic circuit theory you get in all of our bachelor and master's degree level courses, we get a beautiful experience on Ohm's law and Kirchhoff's law and some of Maxwell's equations, some of Faraday's law, and some of Ampere's law. And so when it comes to setting up circuits, RCL circuits, we get a lot of theory in a good school. When it comes to setting up specifically designed magnetic circuits, like transformers, the theory you get in the school is very light and not in useful engineering form. Of the 30 electrical engineers I graduated with from my particular school, 32 of them as I remember, I could tell by querying them, only one or two of them would be able to fix the old-fashioned tube AM radio in their room if it failed. These are guys with a Bachelor of Electrical Engineering school, a degree, from a good New York City school. They're going to go out there in the real world designing radio circuits. They wouldn't be able to fix the radio in their room if it failed. Two guys in the class could do it. The other 30 would say, well, I'll take it to a repair shop. I don't know how to do that. Well, the useful engineering information they got is somewhat lacking. And when it comes to how to design a transformer, of those 32 guys I graduated with, I think two of them would be able to design the right turns ratio on a piece of paper for a transformer if you gave them a list of all the magnetic materials that they could use for that environment. About 2 out of 32, I think, would do that. So it's not their fault. The educational system in that area, in my opinion, is inadequate. So, W2SAW, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Good job. Repeater, timeout.
Now, let's let Eric put in a couple words before, and then you turn it back to Bill. KE2EJ, so then turn it over to SAW, K2RIW. You got it, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Oh, this was an interesting subject for me. A bunch of years ago, I
which building some amplifiers, and I found that there actually are a couple of resources like Amidon that makes toroid or cores. They actually have a white paper where once you particularly select the material based on the parameters of what you're trying to do, they have a series of formulas that help you determine the number of turns for a given impedance at a particular group of frequencies. So there is stuff out there. I mean,